Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am very delighted today to introduce to you a colleague of mine and a very good friend of mine, Dr. David Chandler. Dr. Chandler is now teaching at Kyoto University at the Faculty of Integrated Human Science. He did his graduate studies in the University of London and the University of Oxford. He is primarily a romantic scholar, mainly concentrating on William Wordsworth. However, he became recently a wise man and turned his attention to Dickens. And he has a forthcoming article in the Dickensian on it's a study of MP, if you remember, in that Nicholas Nickleby, Mr. Grimsby, and it is a very interesting article where everybody used to think that Grimsby is just a Dickens general satire, but Dr. Chandler did a thorough research and proves that it has a specific target. I forget who, but you do. today, he is going to regale us with a paper on the Battle of Life. The title of his talk is The Challenge of the Battle of Life. Now, I should think it is a kind of a challenge on Dr. Chandler's part, because everybody knows that the Battle of Life is, if not the worst, but possibly one of really the worst dreadful stories Dickens ever wrote. So I freely confess that I'm all curiosity as to what possibly interesting thing Dr. Chandler can come up with on this abysmal story. So please surprise us, David.
I'm going to try and speak without the microphone. If anyone at the back has a problem hearing me, then please raise your hand and I will try and speak louder. I'm going to start on a personal note. I first read The Battle of Life about 6 years ago, and I quite liked it. And I read it again about 6 months later, and I still liked it, which, as you can tell from Professor Sasaki's remarks, is rather strange, because nobody else likes it. And reading the extant criticism is a disheartening experience. According to Ruth Glancy, the author of an excellent bibliography of the Christmas books, it is, and I quote, "with no argument at all, Dickens' most flawed and disliked work." And perhaps that may give it some intrinsic interest that the second worst work does not have. And having looked at all the criticism, it seems that she's right. It always has been seen as abysmal. But I don't think it's ever really been understood. If it was understood, I'm not sure it would be liked anymore, but I think it could be seen as an interesting and perhaps impressive failure. I've called this talk The Challenge of the Battle of Life, first because it seems to me that Dickens was attempting to write a particular kind of story which offered very real challenges to a 19th century writer, and second because it is perhaps even more of a challenge for the 21st century reader to understand and sympathise with Dickens' narrative goals. Well, before commencing my discussion, I thought I would read through a summary of the story, and this is passage number 2 on the handout, for those of you who maybe have never read this or have read it and forgotten. It's in three parts. In part the first, we are introduced to Dr. Jedler and his daughters, Grace the elder, Marion the younger. Alfred is engaged to Marion, but is going away to study on the continent for 3 years. Part the second is then set nearly 3 years later. We are introduced to Michael Warden, a reckless young squire who has to leave the country, but who has fallen in love with Marion and aims to steal her from Alfred. We learn that Grace and Alfred had been childhood sweethearts. There is a mysterious nocturnal interview between Marion and Michael Warden. On the night of Alfred's return, Marion runs away, as does Warden. Part the third is then set 6 years later. Grace is now married to Alfred. Michael Warden returns from the continent. We learn that he had not, as all have supposed, eloped with Marion. Marion has simply gone away, perhaps with Warden's assistance, to stay at her aunt's house. She returns and explains everything. She had known that Grace loved Alfred, and assumed that, if she was away, Alfred's love would be transferred to Grace, as it has been. There is a final hint that Marion will, at some future date, marry Michael Warden. It is my contention that the Battle of Life should be understood as a late contribution to a particular tradition of friendship literature, and also a revision and reworking of that tradition. Friendship literature flourished in medieval Europe and was concerned with the representation of exemplary male friendship. The particular tradition I'm interested in consists of stories in which a man gives his fiancée to a best friend who has fallen in love with her. I'll call this the gift of the fiancée story. It seems to have had its origins in the Middle East and to have entered Europe in the 12th century. The best known version of this story, described by one scholar as a ubiquitous favourite of the Renaissance, was Boccaccio's story of Titus and Gysippus, the eighth story of the 10th day of the Decameron. All the works I refer to are listed in the first number on the handout. I'll briefly summarise this story to give you some idea of what is involved. It is set in classical Athens. Titus falls in love with Sophronia, who is the fiancée of his friend Gysippus. Agonising over the rival claims of friendship and love, he falls ill. When Gysippus learns the cause of his friend's illness, he offers to give Sophronia to Titus, and she is tricked into consummating her marriage with Titus rather than Gysippus, the man she believes she has married. This is what is sometimes called a bed trick and appears in a few of Shakespeare's plays. Eventually, Gysippus marries Titus's sister, Fulvia, and the two couples live together happily in one house. Although this type of story was always more popular in Italy and France, Boccaccio's version had a considerable impact in England, and there are several English versions dating from the 15th and 16th centuries. By about 1600, however, it was almost impossible to tell the gift of the fiancée story seriously. This appears to have been mainly a result of the fact that romantic love for women had steadily risen in the scale of male values, and that women themselves had come to be taken more seriously as rational creatures, capable of informed choice. It has been argued, in fact, that in the mid-14th century, Boccaccio was already uncomfortable with the narrative assumptions of the Titus-Gysippus story, and that for that reason he set it in the remote classical past, unlike most of the stories in the Decameron. Salvatore Battaglia has suggested that, and this is number 3 on the handout, Boccaccio used a strategic historico-social distance, and consequently a human and psychological one, to make acceptable a case that he felt anachronistic and abnormal. Anachronistic and abnormal. I include Battaglia's comment here because I think it could probably be argued that Dickens was doing something similar in The Battle of Life, set in an idealised, rural, 18th century England, blatantly remote from the settings of most of his works. A sense of pastness or remoteness may be almost essential in this type of story. Anyway, to reiterate, the year 1600 can be taken roughly as the moment when the narrative awkwardnesses inherent in the gift of the fiancé story finally triumphed over its obsolete ideals. There are very few examples in English after this date. Around 1619, John Fletcher, as in Beaumont and Fletcher, wrote a play called Monsieur Thomas, in which, in a subplot, Valentine attempts to give his young friend Francis his fiancée, Celide. The story is now greatly complicated, though, because Celide is furious at being treated in this way. She first refuses to have either man, then runs away to escape what she feels as a conflict between love and duty. The next English example of this kind of friendship story, which I have found, appeared over 100 years later, when in 1759, Oliver Goldsmith included the short story of Alcander and Septimus in his periodical The Bee. Goldsmith's story is not original, however, but a very abbreviated version of Boccaccio's, with the names of the principal male protagonists changed. Goldsmith shows some embarrassment in treating the gift of the fiancé plot, and even some tendency to be critical of it. And this is number 4 on the handout. This is how he hurries through this awkward moment in the story. It would but delay the narrative to describe the conflict between love and friendship in the breast of Alcander. It is enough to say that the Athenians were at that time arrived at such refinement in morals that every virtue was carried to excess. Dickens probably knew this Goldsmith version of the story, even if he didn't know Boccaccio's original. Because of the virtual disappearance of the gift of the fiancé story in the 17th century and later, there is little evidence to show how attitudes to this narrative may have shifted, except for the self-evident fact that it was no longer popular. One way to trace changing attitudes, however, is to consider critical responses to a notorious narrative crux in Shakespeare's work. In the final scene of The Two Gentlemen of Verona, one of his early comedies, and a play, incidentally, sometimes considered Shakespeare's worst, Shakespeare uses the gift of the fiancé topos. In this play, Valentine, the hero, is the lover of Sylvia. Valentine's treacherous friend Proteus attempts to win Sylvia for himself, however, and ends up attempting to rape her. But when Valentine charges him with betrayal, Proteus is immediately repentant. And at this, Valentine not only forgives Proteus, but offers to give him Sylvia. And this famous crux is the key lines are in handout passage 5. The end of Valentine's speech. And that my love may appear plain and free, all that was mine in Sylvia I give thee. there has been some quibbling about those lines. Some critics have tried to suggest that they don't mean what most people assume they do mean. But it's usually been read as that he's giving Sylvia to his friend. All the 18th century commentary on these lines is hostile. 18th century critics found the offer of Sylvia to Proteus dramatically inept, psychologically absurd, and morally disgusting. In the theatre, a substantially adapted version of the text was used, and the offer of Sylvia to Proteus was not made. In the 18th century, then, it can be concluded that the traditions and literature of heroic friendship, which might have explained and dignified Valentine's offer, had been wholly lost sight of, Goldsmith's one little story notwithstanding. But in the early Victorian period, the period of the Battle of Life, critics' attitudes to the two gentlemen of Verona crux suddenly became more sympathetic. And this, I think, points to an important and immediate context for Dickens' story. There is a sort of breakthrough comment in Charles Knight's beautiful pictorial edition of Shakespeare of 1838. Knight, you may know, is a publisher, educationalist, and Shakespeare critic, and was on the fringes of the Dickens circle. He later gave Dickens a volume of his Shakespearean essays. This is Knight's comment, passage 6 on the handout. In the fifth act, unquestionably, the outlines are loosely sketched in, and he quotes Hazlitt. If the text be correct, which makes Valentine offer to give up Sylvia to Proteus, there cannot be a doubt that the poet intended to have worked out this idea and to have exhibited a struggle of self-denial and a sacrifice to friendship, which very young persons are inclined to consider possible. Friendship has its romance as well as love. This notion of the struggle of self-denial applies very well to what Dickens was trying to do in The Battle of Life. In this sense, we can even say that Dickens did what Knight considered Shakespeare to have left undone, though perhaps I might add that Dickens himself felt that he had not fully treated the struggle, and that this short Christmas book should have made a longer novel. In 1843, a minor Shakespearean critic, who I have been able to identify only as J. Ogden, contributed a note on the two gentlemen crux to a new edition of Shakespeare. This is an edition introduced by Barry Cornwall, and this note, for the first time, associated Shakespeare's play with the literary tradition of friendship literature. And this is the next passage on the handout. This sudden renunciation of his mistress by Valentine is certainly startling and perhaps unnatural. But such romantic generosity is not uncommon in fiction, and probably not altogether unknown in actual life. One of Goldsmith's best serious essays, the one we've just heard about, is founded on a similar incident. Whether derived from fact, we are not prepared to say. A curious comment. Ogden was not, it would appear, very knowledgeable on the subject of friendship literature, and apparently had no idea that Goldsmith's story, hardly a serious essay, was derived from Boccaccio. Still, his is a valuable hint, and one that was soon improved by Halliwell Phillips, the greatest Shakespearean scholar of the period. In editions of the play that he published in 1850 and 1854, Halliwell Phillips persuasively linked the two gentlemen and its famous crux with what he called, quote, the ancient tales of perfect friendship. Several 20th century Shakespearean scholars would later develop the suggestion. Although Halliwell Phillips' notes appeared just after the Battle of Leith, Ogden's note precedes it, and it is surely a striking coincidence that Dickens' story appeared in the very decade when English literary critics first reveal an awareness of the long-lost ideals of friendship literature. Before finally saying goodbye to Ogden, let me remark briefly on that strange suggestion that in actual life, and not just literature, may be found the kind of sacrifice which Valentine makes. The Battle of Life includes the same hint. Although we cannot directly connect Dickens with Ogden, we can, of course, connect him very easily with William Charles Macready. In December 1841, just after his move to Drury Lane, Macready directed and starred in a pioneering and seminal performance of The Two Gentlemen of Verona. This was the first known production of the play to include the ending with its famous crux as Shakespeare wrote it. Macready himself played Valentine and is therefore the first known actor to have spoken the lines offering Sylvia to Proteus on stage. The production was highly praised by London critics and decisively restored Shakespeare's unadapted text to favour. I would argue that Macready's decision to restore the ending of The Two Gentlemen was based in part on his recognition that Shakespeare's controversial lines had a literary tradition behind them. In this, Macready anticipates Ogden and indeed all other later critics of the play. In February 1842, just a few days after the successful run of The Two Gentlemen came to an end, Macready put on a production of a new play called Gysippus, adapted from Boccaccio. Macready again played the central character who gives his fiancée to his friend. London audiences who saw both productions were surely being encouraged to compare Shakespeare's play and Boccaccio's story. Excuse me. I want to say a bit more about this play, Gysippus, which was certainly known to Dickens, and which is, arguably, an important source for the Battle of Leith. It was written by the Irish writer Gerald Griffin in 1823, but neither produced nor published. In 1840, after Griffin's death, Macready obtained the manuscript and was extremely impressed by it. On the 17th of October, he read the play to a select dinner party, which included Dickens and Forster. It was extremely well received. Forster, who was hearing it for the second time, had already made the extraordinary claim that Gysippus was, and I quote, above any play since Shakespeare. Now it cast its spell on Dickens too. A few days later he wrote to Macready, I have thought of nothing but that tragedy. Griffin had made a simple but sweeping change to the old Boccaccio story. He introduced a pre-plot in which Fulvius, that is Titus, and Sophronia had been lovers in the past. They parted through some misunderstanding, never clearly explained, but continued to love each other. Some years later, after many struggles, Sophronia finally submits to Gysippus's desire to marry her. Thus, when Fulvius arrives in Athens and meets his friend's fiancée, she is not a stranger to him, as she is in Boccaccio, but an old love who he has thought of every day since they separated. Therefore, when Gysippus surrenders Sophronia to Fulvius, it is not the simple gift that that it is in Boccaccio. It is rather a sort of restoration or a yielding to the force of a previous emotional situation. The act is authentic and meaningful, not just because of Gisippus's generosity, but because of the prior claim that Fulvius has on Sophronia. This makes the story more believable, as well as, in today's terms, more politically correct. When Dickens came to write his own version of the story in The Battle of Life, he learnt from this, again sketching in an obscure pre-plot in which Grace and Alfred had been childhood sweethearts. Like Griffin, Dickens recognised the value of not being too specific, and we never hear how and when Alfred's affections were transferred to the younger sister. Nevertheless, and again like Griffin, the emotional legacy of this earlier relationship, that is Grace's continuing love for Alfred, is clearly represented as legitimizing the central act of friendship in the story, that is Marian's gift of Alfred to Grace. Any friend of Macready was likely then to have some interest in treating the gift of the fiancé story. But besides his English influences, Dickens may have picked up more ideas for his story in Italy. In the 1920s, scholars first drew attention to the two gentlemen of Verona's debt to Italian Commedia dell'arte, improvised comedy based on stock characters and situations developed in the 16th century. Flamininos, Scala's classic 1611 collection of Commedia dell'arte scenarios includes the story of the amico fedeli, or the faithful friend, which incorporates the gift of the fiancé topos and was reworked and adapted by Italian dramatists over the following 250 years, the last being after the Battle of Live. I won't stop to consider the earlier versions of this variant of the gift of the fiancé story here, as it is most unlikely that Dickens would have known them. Though it is worth noting that they are concerned with working their way around awkwardnesses in the story, and there is in general increasing respect for the female protagonist's feelings. With Carlo Goldoni's 1750 play, Il Vero Amico, however, this tradition of Italian theatre produced a comic masterpiece which quickly gained a European reputation, partly because it was imitated by Diderot. When Dickens was in Italy, Goldoni was regarded as the greatest comic playwright the country had produced, and his plays were part of the standard theatrical repertoire. In Pictures from Italy, Dickens notes the production of Goldoni's comedies at the Teatro d'Arno in Genoa, and makes it clear that he sometimes attended this theatre. Although there is no proof that Dickens knew Il Vero Amico, Goldoni's play develops the old gift of the fiancé story in a way which anticipates the Battle of Life. In the climax of this play, the two lovers, Florindo and Rosora, are engaged. Florindo, however, knows that his friend Lelio has a prior claim on Rosora. Putting friendship before love, he gives the woman he loves, and who loves him in return, to his friend, by pretending that he has already secretly married. He tricks her into thinking he is secretly married. He assumes, correctly, that Rosora will be so hurt by his supposed betrayal of her that she will willingly return to Lelio. In The Battle of Life, the motives are described rather differently, and Marian stages an apparent elopement rather than pretending to have secretly married. Still, the narrative structure is very similar. Indeed, in all the extant friendship literature that I know, there is no work which more closely anticipates Dickens' story than Il Vero Amico. What I've been trying to show, then, is that the battle of life is a type of story which has its narrative roots, its literary genetics, we can say, in the friendship literature of an earlier age. It is precisely Dickens' difficulties in updating this material which create most of the problems that critics have found in the plot. From the time of its first publication, it has been felt that Marion's apparent elopement, besides being intrinsically silly, creates far more suffering for all those around her, including Grace, than her marriage to Alfred could possibly have done. Yet Dickens represents it as heroic self-sacrifice, suggesting that the story does not altogether successfully transplant its obsolete ideals. A related issue is the way Alfred is treated, not just by Marion, but by the narrative. He is in fact treated rather like the ladies in earlier versions of the Gift of the Fiancé story. His feelings are not consulted, and an awful lot rests on the assumption that his feelings of love are conveniently transferable. The supposed elopement is also awkwardly handled. Dickens was here torn between the narrative necessity of making it appear that Marion had eloped with Warden, and a contradictory desire of representing her as so angelic that she couldn't possibly have done so. When he found that John Leech had included an illustration of Warden actually waiting to receive Marion on the night of her flight, this is the last number on the handout, he described himself as experiencing, quote, a horror, an agony not to be expressed. In other words, Dickens felt that Warden was not there in that scene, though in many ways the narrative leads one to suppose that he was. Goldoni handled his version of this awkward plot much better. For when Florendo says he is secretly married, the audience knows he is lying. So the lofty, self-sacrificial ideals he represents are much less compromised by his deception. Besides, Goldoni treated the whole thing in an exuberantly farcical spirit, while Dickens takes it seriously. But let me end on a more positive note. Dickens transforms the old type of male friendship story into a tale of sisterly love. Several post-war critics have been inclined to source this sister's plot in Dickens' complicated feelings towards the Hogarth sisters. Yet the dramatic perspective is certainly not that of the passive Alfred. And it seems to me, as I've argued today, that the battle of life's plot is an essentially literary one. Early critics who expressed dismay at Dickens' treatment of Alfred apparently failed to recognise that he was a literary descendant of many docile females who had been passed from one male lover to another. In this sense, despite a slightly porcelain-like, old-fashioned quality, the battle of life has an undeniable feminist edge, probably unthinkable before the 18th century. But this radical element must be balanced against the seemingly conservative notion of making the two female protagonists sisters rather than mere friends, and therefore the whole emotional transaction a kind of family affair. This may have something to do with Dickens' own feelings about family, so strongly present in all the Christmas books, but may also reflect, at a broader level, the emerging Victorian nuclear family ethos, with its tendency to regard friends not just as a complement to, but as an outside threat to family. Indeed, the story, in a sense, can be read as suggesting that even the most accommodating kinds of lover are a threat to the emotional integrity of family. So, Dickens seems to be updating an old story in a way which is not just of literary interest, but which reflects larger social changes. Thank you very much.